Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us each Friday at this time for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Welcome back to you.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot of lessons last week in Jerusalem.
I'll bet you did.
Oh, yeah.
You shouldn't cancel our segment because you get punished.
The truth is I could have conducted it because I was pretty bored stuck in my hotel room. One of the worst non-appointments in Jerusalem city history was that the mayor of Jerusalem never appointed a Canadian to head his meteorological department because all he really needed, frankly, with everything we've discussed this so much over the last 8 days, but with everything we've discussed, all he really needed was a couple of people who knew what to do during a snowstorm, and half of the trouble that was going on in Jerusalem last week would have been averted. It was really something. By the way, I did find one shovel. I don't know if you saw this. We posted it on the social media sites. I was looking for days. Would I see one shovel? Would I see any shoveling going on that was not being done with a sponge stick or with a broom or with water? A lot of people actually, in order to get the snow away, they actually water the snow with a hose, which I thought was a unique way of handling it. I had never
Do
seen
Do they know about freezing?
I'm telling you, that's what was so funny about it. But then on Sunday, I'm walking in the Shuk after a treacherous walk through the middle of town. I'm walking in the Shuk. And sure enough, I find a shovel. Somebody's on the roof of one of the Shuk booths trying to get the snow off the roof. That's what they were using the one shovel I saw for. So, you know, they're a little behind when it comes to this stuff.
I see a new Seagull venture coming up here.
Yeah, what's that?
Salt and shovels.
Salt, shovels. I want to tell you something. I found they have these portable shovels that fold up. That's going to be the next gift for the Siegel family of Jerusalem, I can tell you that much. All they needed is one shovel. It would have been a lot easier. Anyway, a lot of lessons learned. Unfortunately, a lot of tragedies with all the joking we've been doing and all the stories we've been telling. A very dangerous situation for a lot of people. There were deaths and there were a lot of injuries, and it was a very difficult situation. In fact, you know, Malcolm, it took days for some areas to get back power and heat and water and everything. So it was a...
We should remind them of the Lindsay lesson.
Yeah.
For politicians, it's not a good thing not to respond in times like this.
But you can't do it without the proper equipment. I think Lindsay had the trucks. I just don't think he...
They just didn't put him out in Queens.
Yeah, they didn't deal with it efficiently. Anyway, we'll see if it does affect the political career of the mayor or anybody else who was involved. And already the polls in Israel indicate, you know, who the biggest enemy, it seems, this week? The electric company. Doesn't that sound familiar? That those who provide electricity are the ones who are first blamed during storms like this? But they are thawing out, and that's what's happening in Jerusalem and so many other parts of Israel. A unique experience, to say the least. Malcolm, what is the story behind the escape of Jacob Oestreicher from Bolivia? I remind the listeners that he was incarcerated there for the last couple of years, and I believe he was actually freed at one point from jail, but not allowed out of the country. Is that accurate?
He was at his home.
He was at his home in Bolivia.
And then part of the time, I think, he opted not to leave because he was really seeking justice, not just to escape. And I did speak to him in prison, and no one can imagine what a Bolivian prison is. There were, I think, 2,500 of the most vicious criminals, and he had to arrange for protection, and while he was under lock and key. So I'm sure he needs now time to rest and recuperate, but a lot of people were involved, and I have to say many governments, U.S. government, had very limited leverage because they don't have diplomatic relations, but many people got involved in this, and thank God now let's hope this
so I'm saying,
nightmare for him is over.
So right now he's in New York?
I don't know.
No, you don't know where he is, but he... I can't get the story straight. Did he escape or not?
He's out.
Yes. He's out. He's definitely outside the country of Bolivia at
this
time.
And he's here in the United States.
And he's in the U.S.
He just needs time to...
Right, so we don't know where he is, and we don't know who actually carried out or helped out in this final stage of releasing him.
Well, Sean Penn clearly was involved.
No, I'm talking about the actual
episode.
Like, no, are they saving it for the movie? Is that it?
To Miriam Unger, you know, who was his wife, and was amazing in her tenacity throughout all of this and her courage, but I didn't ask those questions because when they're ready to say it, they'll say it.
I understand, but I'm not even being that facetious when I say this. Maybe they're saving the story for some big production or something. I don't know.
Sean Sean Penn will play also.
I would guess, or maybe they're just going on some talk show and waiting for all that to be revealed at that time. Who knows? So here are the big stories in Israel. I'll save the pop culture stuff from you because I did that earlier in the week. But the big news in Israel, of course, what photos President Obama did or did not take at the Mandela Memorial. That was a big thing going on in Israel. I heard it was big in the U.S. also, by the way, that story. But you know what was even bigger in Israel? The fact that Bibi didn't go to the memorial service. And apparently the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, did not as well. Did the two of them make a mistake?
Well, it's a mistake in the sense that it became such a big issue there and elsewhere. Israel did have representation. The third ranking person in the government, Yuli Edelstein, who's the speaker of the Knesset, did go with a delegation. But I think at that point it already had become seen as a last resort move by having him go, even though had he been the first to be announced, I think it would have been in keeping with many other delegations. But because you had 70 countries and the United President of the United States, former presidents, others there, that was seen as an opportunity, also because of the controversy, the history. It's a very complicated history between Mr. Mandela and Israel, although now there are reports that the Mossad may have trained him in Uganda when he was an officer or something. There are so many stories, and I was a little bit involved in some aspects of this. It was very complicated, and people tend to look at it simplistically and say, well, Israel supported apartheid, didn't support apartheid. It isn't true. Israel has always been outspoken against apartheid, and when South Africa, even though they were cooperating in some military and other senses, people have to remember Israel didn't have any other options. Nobody in Africa was dealing with Israel, and there were very important strategic interests. So the president, I think the prime minister should have gone. The fact that it costs money and that he had become the subject of so much media scrutiny and criticism because of the budget that's entailed in being prime minister, running his home and other things, I think he shied away, and Peres wasn't feeling well, and I think also wasn't feeling up to the trip. Hindsight, maybe the decision should have been to go.
Well, with all the nitpicking,
but there's also another factor, and that is that his presence would have evoked demonstrations and response. And, you know, that there are plenty of elements in South Africa, there are very radical elements who would have used the opportunity to demonstrate against him. So that's an important consideration. But I think the president's actions really overshadowed that controversy and knocked it off the front page and the attention of people.
I don't know about Israel, but maybe here, yeah.
Right, and then it's not just the picture with the Danish prime minister and the selfie and the whole question of the propriety at a funeral, even though it wasn't, you know, a tragic event. It was he was 95 and he had been sick, and he lived a very full and quite amazing life. The picture that bothered me the most, though, was the picture that came out of him shaking hands with the head of this. Of the Polisario, which is a terrorist organization based in Algeria that seeks to overthrow the government of Morocco, well, certainly to claim the Western Sahara. It is a group that has been tied recently to helping, being a breeding ground for Al-Qaeda in Algeria for troops that went to fight in Mali and elsewhere. And the president, and I'm pretty sure he didn't know who he was meeting, but the very fact that he would meet this guy Abdulaziz and would shake hands and have that picture then appear in a number of Arab websites, you can be sure that the king of Morocco is livid about this. In a time when we've had tensions with Morocco, which is our best ally certainly in North Africa, it's comparable to shaking hands with the head of Hezbollah or Hamas for Israel or for Egypt.
It sounds like you have definitive information that the head of the king of Morocco is livid.
Let me say, as an educated guess, and because we've had tensions with him till now of late, and it was resolved We thought with the visit of the king to the president a couple weeks ago, and now this, and you know that there's no issue more sensitive for Morocco than the issue of the Polisario and what happens in Western Sahara, which they claim, and the UN and others want to have a plebiscite and give it independence or more rights. It's a very contentious issue. So the sighting of him with of shaking hands with the president, with the head of this group, was certainly, I assure you, deeply controversial there.
Did he shake hands or meet the leader of Cuba?
He did, and Castro said, "I'm Castro," according to Fidel yesterday. That was the conversation, but he did, and he shook hands with him.
And back to Bibi for a second. So I know that the Israeli media is nitpicking on all these expenses and stuff. It's a big issue there in terms of what he and his office and home spend money on or don't spend money on, etc. But it seems is a poor excuse for not being at the memorial service. It would seem that the threat of protests or maybe the atmosphere that would have been generated by his presence is likely more of what went into making that decision, right?
But the Prime Minister of Israel can't determine how he fulfills his responsibilities because of his concern that there will be, you know, hostile elements. I think it would be inappropriate, seen as inappropriate at the event, to have demonstrations against the Prime Minister of Israel.
And nobody else who was there prompted demonstrations in South Africa?
I did not see any reports of any demonstrations. That doesn't mean there weren't. There were people that have occasion for it. But that should not determine where the Prime Minister goes, unless there's a real security concern. And I know that the security did not want Perez to go. They were very concerned about it.
So wrap this up for me. How would you describe the leadership of South Africa's relationship with the current leadership in Israel?
The current leadership in South Africa?
Right.
Well, Zuma, I would say that the relationship is a very cold one and distant.
It's funny that I, as a regular person, don't pick that up.
Well, it's not. He's not as blatant, and he has. I actually met him on two occasions, once at great length at his home, and once on a much shorter period. And in our discussions, he was fine on Israel. But as you know, that there was a lot of pent-up animosity, and you have Muslim groups, you have other elements, and the ANC, which takes a very pro-Palestinian position. And then in the UN, South Africa votes against Israel.
Right. America, that I should have remembered. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein's with us, weekly update. There was a rejection. The bill did not pass, which would have required a two-thirds majority in the Knesset to divide Jerusalem in any future negotiations with the Arabs. Is this only because of the current environment with Kerry shuttling back and forth and making his eighth, ninth, or tenth trip to the region, or would this have been an overwhelming defeat anyway for this bill, no matter when it took place in the Knesset?
Look, I think it certainly is affected by it and the message that it would send, but it is surprising that you can't get two-thirds of. But I think many people just assume that this is an issue, that anything in dealing with Jerusalem would be so controversial and would require an overwhelming vote in order to pass.
You know that Kerry says there'll be a full deal by April. Does he realize you need two really willing partners to do that?
Well, he said that there's a possibility because you have a deadline of April, and I think he was trying to put pressure on the Palestinians, say, look, there's enough progress, and the Palestinians did come out and say that they would agree to an extension of the deadline if, in fact, the process was moving along. And it seems that Israel and Kerry seem to be closer on their positions than Kerry to the Palestinians, who have been very critical. And Abbas wrote a letter to President Obama this week complaining about the positions. One of the key issues, of course, is the presence of Israeli troops in the Jordan Valley, which Kerry has supported and talked about a 10-year presence. And Abbas rejects it. He also rejects the call for recognition in an agreement of Israel as a Jewish state. Those are two of the points that, amongst several, that he raised in his letter, and the Palestinians accused Kerry of being an agent of the Zionists, and that did not like his proposals.
So is he in Israel this moment? I know he was there last weekend. Is he there this moment, Kerry? He's not?
No.
And
and
what happened? What's the timetable?
Going there so often, I shouldn't say. But
yeah, I mean, my point
shows up very quickly.
Yeah, my point is that April's today. Like, this, it's now. If there's, and I understand the
Well, they're talking about a framework. I don't think they're talking about all the details. It's just not possible to do it in this kind of period, to come to a final agreement. And with all the other things, the issues in the region, the stability of Jordan, the unrest, the uprising in Syria, the other issues that are confronting them, the differences about whether you have radar parts, installations in the west on the mountains in Yehuda and Shomron, what happens to the existing populations, that they're talking more of a framework agreement. He is saying, well, look, the Palestinians don't want interim agreements. They want to have final status issues. Israel's saying, look, you got to deal with the critical issues, but the fact is that you got to address those issues, and Jerusalem alone cannot possibly be resolved in any kind of a short period. So the likelihood that you'll have something by April beyond a framework agreement, beyond having the basics in line, I think is very very limited. But he's been focusing, and that General Allen is there working on the security arrangements. He has 122 people on his staff. So this is not a minor operation.
They all travel with him?
I don't think they travel with him all the time. Most of them are stationed there or elsewhere,
right.
And they work on all the details, all the security details. This is a big undertaking, and Martin Indyk, who's serving to help with the process on an ongoing basis, I think he already has 12 people on his staff. And and the PA faces a lot of challenges still from Hamas and Hezbollah. They see the growth of the Salafi movement, the increasing terrorism and the terror attacks in Yehuda and Shomron and Yerushalayim, 65% increase. And they continue to resort to the same kind of incitement, the same kind of baiting. Just on the issue of Al-Aqsa, the criticism of Israel that Al-Aqsa, which is in the hands of the Waqf, the Islamic Trust, and it's which is supposed to be run by Jordan, and Saudi Arabia claims it, and Morocco claims their roles as preeminent protectors of Jerusalem. There was an interesting story that they collect $285,000 a month in collections, in contributions, charitable contributions on Harabayit from visitors to the mosques. $285,000 a month, and nobody knows where the money goes, because it's certainly not going to maintaining the places or sustaining them. So there were many questions that keep coming up about the corruption, the fact that you have no transparency, the fact that money keeps coming in, people's the Qataris or others give money, but they all say it's like a bottomless pit. You can pour money in, doesn't seem to get to the people. And with the one person who had any level of transparency, which Fayyad, is gone.
Yeah, but that's like a passing the plate issue. You know what I mean? Like, that's not. You're talking about money as people visit, like they would give money to any religious institution they'd
right,
walk
and
into.
Right, and it ends up in people's pockets. But
yeah, I understand.
My point is that they keep attacking
right.
The situation of Al-Aqsa, the mosques on Harabayit, and blaming Israel that they're not kept up. Whereas their responsibility to keep them up, and they get millions of dollars in income, and nothing is being used, obviously, to advance it. The one good news was this agreement between Israel, the Palestinians, and Jordanians for the Red Sea water pipeline,
right.
Which will bring 100 million cubic meters of water annually to the Dead Sea.
Yeah, very important for the future. And also we should note the cooperation that the IDF and Israelis in general gave to those who may not necessarily have been Jewish citizens of Israel during the storm last weekend.
And of course, and to the people in the PA, they helped them a lot. And you saw that the Hamas people were claiming that the floods in Gaza, which displaced 40,000 people, were, of course, because Israel opened floodgates. The problem is there are no floodgates. So it's a little hard for them to have, breaking dams that don't exist.
Yeah, but you know how it is. If you propagandize enough, people will believe it.
It's not never to be dismissed. And why I raise it only is because
You
got a lot of people out there believing.
Right. And on the Al-Aqsa thing, as we always say, you control the past, you control the future. And that's all part of the battle of controlling the past. Is the BB Yair Lapid rift getting bigger?
Look, it appears to be, but they need each other right now. I think nobody in Israel wants to go to elections. The big vote will be, in fact, in Likud regarding Lieberman, the alliance between Lieberman and Bibi, the merger of the two parties. And there's a lot of dissension in the Likud ranks. But I think right now, if you look at the polls, none of the parties, not Lieberman, not Lapid, no one really does well. So I think that there will be a hesitancy to in any way undermine the government now.
Anything significant to tell us regarding Bibi's meeting with the Pope?
The fact that the Pope is coming to visit Israel, and a Pope that is extremely popular. And
when will that be?
That is going to be, I think, I have the dates. I think it was...
Early 2014 or?
May, I think it was in
May. Of 2014.
March or May. I know it was an M. It was March or May.
And, he is very popular and agreeing to come to Israel. We should remind everybody that a papal visit to Israel was only once in the last century, right? Am I right? It was only once?
No. Well,
was there more than one?
The last pope also visited.
Oh, so twice?
And I was there, actually, because it was a sort of challenge we made during our visit and said that if he goes, we'll come.
Wow.
So when he made the announcement, they sent me a note and said, you'll come. And I actually was at the Kotel when he came, and he gave us these gold medals and the visit. And he made some very good statements, if you remember, at the time. So, but a papal visit also at a time when we see these efforts to delegitimize Israel, it is really very important.
All right, so I'll be coming up. The prisoner release issue, as we mentioned Kerry and the peace process and the deadlines and the extensions, etc. There will be another prisoner release this month, or is that going to be extended, that deadline?
I don't think so. I think that Netanyahu has said that he would abide by the agreement unless there's some major violation on the part of the Palestinians.
So when is it for, like in the next week?
No, I don't think it's the next week.
Oh,
I think it's fourth. Between now and April, so probably January, as I recall. I don't know if they set the date, if they announced the date.
I don't know why I heard it was before the end of 2013, but there is a group of people in Israel, a grassroots group, that's really starting to heat up on this whole issue of prisoner release. I think to an extent, they were tolerant of it during the beginning of this process and now are really being fueled.
Well, mostly because they see that the other side is not coming through, it's not delivering on any of their promises, that the increase in violence and the... the people who are being released are serious threats.
Yeah, no question about that. Why was Aleppo under fire this week? What's happening in Syria?
Oh, I hear there's a war there, but beyond that, this is a growing confrontation.
Well, is Aleppo the hub of the rebel activity, of the opposition?
But the outskirts of Damascus, the outskirts of Aleppo, and since the beginning of this war, I said the war will be determined if Aleppo or Damascus falls, Assad falls. He can't exist without the two of them. Those are the two main bases for his control. And so they're fighting in the suburbs, but it's also counter-fighting. And there were some serious incidents in which one rebel group, an extreme Islamist front group, captured the warehouses of the in which a lot of weapons from the United States and the West were stockpiled. General Idris, who was in charge, fled to Turkey, and now he's in Doha on vacation. The fighting there is very serious, and there were reports that the incendiary devices were used by the rebels or by the government, that there were extensive bombings by the Syrian Air Force, and in one day alone, I think 126 people were killed, including many children. As of now, over 11,000 children have been killed in
wow.
Syria. And 126, perhaps 130,000 people. And the fighting continues, and you have this big disparity between the groups. You have the growth of the al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, extremist groups. I think the Free Syrian Army and the Islamic Front, which some people claim is not Islamist, although I think it clearly is, are weaker, and the divisions are going to make it very hard to come have an opposition come in united way to the talks at Geneva. Some of the groups already have boycotted it. Assad said he wasn't going to go. They're demanding Assad fall. Iran, Syria, Russia, and, of course, the government of Syria are not going to allow Assad to fall. So the word now is you got to get ready that Assad stays. To me, the biggest story is not just the United States has indicated they're prepared to meet with the Islamist Front, which is, I think, again, a big mistake. But the announcement on an issue which I've talked here and talked to the governments of people involved and always asking about this for more than a year, there was an announcement about the number, a report, rather, on the number of foreign fighters in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
You remember I talked about the fact that there were 300 or 500 or up to 1,000.
Right. And then the question is if their mother country would take them back, et cetera.
That's exactly.
Right.
Now the estimate is that the number tripled since April from 600 to more than 1,900 Western Europeans alone.
Wow.
Doesn't include Americans. That altogether there are 11,000 individuals from 74 countries who become opposition fighters in Syria. This is not the guys fighting with the government. It's talking about only those fighting with the rebels.
Right.
And this has doubled in the last few months. They're more than 10% of the extreme opposition. These guys are going to go home. Now we've heard since then a report that 1,000 people from Saudi Arabia have come there to fight. Some are saying the Saudis are encouraging it, to join the Sunni forces. They are backing them. They're talking about going it alone on Iran and on Syria because they're so disappointed with the United States, angry at the United States even over this issue. The growth of refugees, 6.5 million now, many of them in Lebanon, in Jordan, Syria, in Turkey, and from Turkey going into Bulgaria and to other countries in Europe, which is causing backlash and extreme right parties that are rising to counter them, and maybe Turkey deliberately doing this to Bulgaria. But the manifestations, the ramifications beyond just the immediate fighting is so great, and the idea when these guys are going to go home, what kind of damage? I mean, they're trained killers now. They've been fighting on a front line.
Talk about a domino effect.
Exactly right. That this could have ramifications after ramifications about what it will mean when you have 300, 400 guys from France alone. You know, that 10 guys can disrupt a country, 10 terrorists who are trained. Just think of what hundreds of these guys coming back. And some countries will make sure they don't return, but that's still a limited group. And the people should read the study to see how well documented it is about the extent of this involvement. And the governments have taken very few steps to address this.
Wow. So curious about your reaction to this, and you can imagine how so many of our listeners asked me to ask you this. The 5,000-member American Studies Association, which bills itself as the nation's oldest and largest association devoted to American culture and history, voted Sunday to boycott Israeli academic institutions. More than 1,200 members voted. 66% endorsed the resolution, which was unanimously supported earlier this month by the group's National Council. This, of course, this is a subset, a subgroup, but it does go against most of the polls that you generally quote to us about support for Israel here in the United States. What's your reaction to this news story?
Okay, so it is important, but you have to understand this is a very radical group. It is not a large association. They have they claim 5,000 members, but only 3,600 eligible to vote. Of those, 1,400 they say voted for it. So it turns out that it's 16% of the membership voted in favor of this resolution. 8 of their past presidents of the association came out against it. Two colleges, Penn State at Harrisburg and Brandeis, have already quit the association. Others are going to do so. People should write to their alma maters and say, don't give them money. That's what Lawrence Summers, the former president of Harvard and Secretary of Treasury, said, that they're free to make whatever decisions they want, but universities should not be subsidizing people to participate or pay dues for them, especially those that receive government monies. So it is significant in the sense that it's going to be now taken up by the Modern Languages Association, which is a big group, about 30,000 members, and others. It sort of opens the floodgate, in a sense, for more of these actions, but they have been going on all along. And it's not because this has any radical impact. And it is an ad, I think, it was supposed to appear today, or signed by the friends of all these major Israeli universities, saying, you want to boycott the cancer treatments, you want to boycott all the other technological advances from Israel. And nobody reminds them that all the Palestinian universities were started under Israel. They didn't have a single one before 67, including Al-Quds and all the rest, were all started since the, quote, occupation. Second, you think of all of the terrible groups in the world, countries in the world, and their human rights record, that you start with one of those that is a real democracy and respects human rights, et cetera, and they said, well, you have to start somewhere. Well, I think we have to start somewhere, and this is really, I think, immense.
So on the human rights issue, best to start with Israel, in their opinion.
Exactly, and I think that we have to be clear. The BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, delegitimization movement is serious. It's here in the United States. It's growing in the United States. We're seeing people coming out and reacting because they're finally come to the recognition. I created a task force on this a couple of years ago, and we have our lawfare project has been dealing with the legal aspects. We're looking at their tax-exempt status or whether they're a violation of some of the boycott or human rights laws by this. But more than that, where is the moral outrage that should be expressed at this attempt to isolate Israel and the global campaign? Even Abbas came out against the boycott of Israel and said, look, we have relations with Israel, we don't support a boycott. So as much as people may think this is unimportant, I just saw a story about this. There's a new Nazi salute sweeping Europe that this comedian Dudien, who's a blatantly anti-Semitic racist guy, but it's where they put one hand on their shoulder and the other hand, the right hand sticking out. So it's not a violation of the law in many countries where the Nazi salute is banned and the swastikas are banned.
They've altered it. They've kashered it.
They right, exactly. Yeah. But the fact that you have these anti-Semitic parties, the extremist parties rising up all over Europe, these are all related, that once you start this campaign of delegitimization, it morphs clearly into what it really is, which is anti-Semitic. They just go after the corporate Jew, the collective Jew, Israel, rather than starting off against the individual Jew. This should be taken very seriously. When we saw in University of Michigan last week where they handed out in a dormitory eviction notices telling them you have 3 days or something to get out, and this is what Israel does to Palestinians. And the university's reaction was very muted. No students, nobody was held to account for...
And I bet you we have a lot of Michigan alum in this audience, by the way.
I bet we do. I'm certainly hoping that they have by now seen the story and have
that's the
administration and telling them what they expect of them. And we have to hold everybody to account. You don't dismiss when what's his name, the guy from Pink Floyd,
Roger Waters.
You know, his blatantly hostile attacks and anti-Semitism. And in one of the concerts, they had a pig with a mug and dove, a Star of David on it. And
I want you to debate him. Would you do that?
Would I debate him?
Yeah.
I don't stoop that low, but I would not, because I mean, I'm not afraid of taking him on a substance because he doesn't know what he's talking about, and it's just hatred and blatant anti-Semitism. I don't think you dignify people like that. I don't think that we should make clear people, not no one in the entertainment world ought to be associating and should not be supporting these kind of guys. And when we dismiss it, when we honor people who can continue to make such comments, and when political leaders make comments, when others, you know, respond, there has to be a clear denunciation, not by Jews, but by non-Jews, by people who will be affected, as well as we have to do our part.
All right, I hate to do this with only 30 seconds left, but if you're a fan of Iran, good news. The nuclear chief says the six-month freeze will not hinder the country's nuclear program. So even if they go into this deal with the U.S., the Iranians think they're home free.
For one thing, we should make clear this is not because it's not a priority. There's just so many things that we didn't talk
about. Yeah, I know, of course.
No, but I want the audience to understand that the danger of Iran grows. Yesterday there was the introduction very courageously by Senator Menendez of New Jersey and Senator Schumer of New York. Both of them should hear from every one of your listeners today, thanking them for standing up for this, Senator Kirk of Ohio, the others, 23 of the 26 who signed on, against tremendous opposition from the administration, with the 10 of the co-chairs, including people like Dianne Feinstein and Ron Wyden and Carl Levin, coming out against it. This legislation includes a six-month hiatus before it goes into effect. It gives the administration more leverage. That's the argument for it. The Iranians have to see it, because look at the statements they're making. Yesterday, Zarif, the foreign minister, said in 24 hours we can be back 20% enrichment.
Unbelievable.
They've changed the language, and it's interesting because this is, you know, everything is important, but for the Iranians, the simple use of a term, they no longer call it an agreement. They call it a letter of intent.
Mm.
And that tells you what the real thing is. They have no intention of going ahead with this. They're just staging war games. They're the largest war games they've ever done, both in the Persian Gulf, started there in the Straits of Hormuz area, moving up with planes, with tanks, with ships, with other things. They are engaged in all sorts of provocative actions. And when the French foreign minister says that our job is to make sure there's no breakout, he doubts that they can reach an agreement. Cameron of England has come out strongly about his doubts, and that we have to hold Iran's feet to the fire, because they're saying, look, we see already the collapse of the sanctions regime. The Europeans, the others, their exports of oil is up 85,000 barrels a day to 850,000. It's still below the million they had. The sanctions still remain in place, and the United States continues to impose. And last week added additional individuals and countries, companies, to the sanctions list, most based in Singapore or in Asia. So, I mean, it's just so much going on this issue. But remember, this is the central issue right now.
100%. More about Iran next week. By the way, two Sundays ago, I was in Amsterdam. You've been in the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, I assume. One of the most amazing buildings I've ever been in my life. Unbelievable.
And we should remember the synagogue in Syria, where they're holding Sefer Torah in the hands of one of the terrorist groups, we believe. We should not jump all over the story till we find out the facts. I mean, this is a classic case of the Merami Rottenberg, about when you have to be careful not to just fall into the trap, because then every synagogue in Syria will become a potential victim for them.
Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak next week. Malcolm Hohenlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.